the presentations by my colleagues were, as expected, stunning and insightful, and it reminds me why I left a private university to come to UCLA, to come here to be with colleagues like this, to be with students like you, to be involved with anything having to do with SJP, which is one of my favorite organizations of all time. Yep. And we really talk about having comrades, you know, to have real comrades. I mean, when I first met DC, I was like, his book changed my life. It was a book that I read on my way to Palestine in January of 2012, and it really changed my life. Corresponding with David Shorter in the struggles, you don't even have a clue how much pressure he was on unless you were in his class. It's tremendous. And the fact is, you know, we're living in a moment when the university could spend all this money to produce a climate report, right? And not even deal with the oppression in the 21st century, deep into it, of our faculty in a climate that's supposed to believe in academic freedom. But we'll get to that. That's not what I'm going to talk about today. I also really am always excited about the work that SJP does all the time, not just Palestine Awareness Week, but all the time. And it reminds me of my days back in the 1980s here at UCLA, the height of the anti-apartheid movement, the tent city. I had organized a conference in 1984 on imperialism, actually, called Imperialism Real or Imagined, and invited a representative from the PLO. And what happened, of course, the Jewish Defense League showed up, as they showed up to everything, armed. And when my sister, who was the chair of the Black Student Alliance, also organized an event and brought members of the PLO, it's about 1983, Jewish Defense League showed up, you know, armed. And I don't ever remember the university putting out a climate report under those circumstances. But it was very interesting, though. And by the way, the President's Advisory Council on Campus Climate, Culture, and Inclusion is a checkpoint. Okay, if you don't know, read it. Okay, so I am supposed to address two questions. One, what are the similarities between the struggles of Palestinians and the struggles of African Americans? And two, why is it important for African Americans to stand for Palestinian rights? The first I'm going to address very briefly, in part because Professor Mardisi provided brilliant examples with regard to apartheid. And, you know, it's just, they're just very direct and irrefutable examples, particularly when you look inside of Israel itself. I'm also interested in context, because one of the things that happens when we make too many comparisons, like, for example, you know, the historical context, if it's very different, can change circumstances. Like, for example, we talk about al-Nakba and histories of Black violent dispossession. I mean, sometimes those histories can be a century apart or more. If you think about the legacy of settler colonialism on African Americans and people of African descent all over, I mean, these are really useful comparisons to make. We can think about the draconian system of apartheid and formal segregation, or more recently, the state's use of the prison as a means of disciplining and warehousing Palestinians and Black people, and that can go on and on and on. But my worry always is that none of these really captures the specificity of violence, dispossession, and subjugation that Palestinians face. Or the particular facts on the ground. It's not, as Professor Mardisi pointed out, Desmond Tutu is one of many who say the conditions in Palestine and the occupied territories, let alone inside of Israel, are worse than apartheid in South Africa. That doesn't mean that apartheid in South Africa wasn't violent, people died as a result. What it means is that sometimes we underestimate, unless we sort of know what's going on, what the situation is like, what the occupation looks like, what the conditions inside of Israel look like for Palestinians. Likewise, if we think about comparisons with regard to strategies and tactics of movement, sometimes the comparisons have been used, actually used by liberals, to bludgeon Palestinian organizations. Mm-hmm. Give you an example. For so long, the big mantra among liberals is, why, how come the Palestinians can't be nonviolent? How come they can't lead an organization like, Southern Conference, the SCLC or SNCC, mm-hmm. or nonviolent movements? And then when Palestinian civil society groups actually do form a nonviolent movement, that's BDS, it's considered a terrorist organization. You know, it's criminalized. So you can't win, no matter what. So that's just my little introduction. But the second question for me is a bit easier, though when you combine it with the first question, it gets complicated. So my personal answer to the question of why should African Americans be in solidarity with Palestinians? I mean, it's simple. Everyone should stand for justice everywhere. Period. There's never any. But what does it actually mean, and what are the lessons we might take from the Black Freedom Movement? That, to me, is the question I want to wrestle with. Because it gets complicated and clearer at the same time. It allows us, for example, to acknowledge that shared race or nationality alone doesn't make a movement. Being Black doesn't make a movement, trust me. And indeed, Black people have often served as junior partners to our oppressors, mm-hmm. lieutenants in the army of white supremacy and class oppression, overlords and patriarchal systems of gender and sexual subjugation, promoters, defenders, spokespersons for neoliberalism as we speak. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, I know more Negro neoliberals than I know, Black socialists, sadly. Not that I'm friends with them. And when it comes to the question of African-American solidarity with Palestine, we have to acknowledge the plethora of Black Zionist organizations committed to defending Israel and supporting the war on Palestinians. And I feel bad because I feel like I'm bringing everybody down now. Okay, AIPAC and Christians United for Israel, CUFI, have been working overtime to recruit Black students, elected officials, religious leaders, to serve as moral shields for Israel's policies of subjugation, settlement, segregation, and dispossession. And then there is the reprehensible Negro apologist in the form of the Vanguard Leadership Group, which I've written about, a self-proclaimed student group made up of graduates from historically Black colleges and universities. Its leadership, of course, on the payroll for AIPAC. On the payroll, not even like hidden money. They're official leaders. So what is new about the circumstance with regard to kind of Black Zionist organizations is the degree to which the Israel lobby is working hard to recruit African Americans and other people of color. But Black support for Israel goes way back to its founding in 1948. And it's complicated. It has to do with things like the prevalence of the ways in which African Americans have read the Old Testament as a kind of metaphor for understanding New World slavery. That's part of it. It's also tied to the persistence, the persistence of this way of thinking has much to do with our utter ignorance of the global landscape made possible by the everyday miseducation of the media and formal education that we get at high-level universities like this one, let alone public schools. So figures as diverse, to go back in time, figures as diverse as Walter White of the NAACP, W.E. Du Bois, A. Philip Randolph, all celebrated the founding of Israel in 1948. They called for partition and were eerily silent on Nakba. The NAACP passed a resolution stating that, quote, the valiant struggle of the people of Israel for independence served as an inspiration to all persecuted people throughout the world. Now, of course, the position shifted, partly as a result of the 67 war, partly as Black radicals proclaimed solidarity with Palestinian resistance as a national liberation movement. Now, certainly, there are direct examples of solidarity with Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, with the Black Panther Party, the creation of the Black Panther Party of Israel, which is made up mostly of women's rights movement. But then, once we start looking at this, we have to interrogate a kind of knee-jerk nationalism that has informed so many of our movements in solidarity with national liberation struggles. Mm-hmm. And I'm old enough to have gone through some of these major nationalist movements myself. And I think I'm the oldest person on the panel. In fact, I know I'm the oldest person. So, what does this look like? Well, the formulation that all Palestinians are good and oppressed, all Israelis are bad and oppressors, and we end up with a critique, and a bereft, really, of a critique of the Palestinian Authority, of Palestinian elites promoting neoliberal policies, or the place of the Israeli left, or what it means when software companies are exploiting ultra-Orthodox women in the occupied territories to work as low-wage laborers, or the various political, ideological, and class contradictions that erupt in any movement. In other words, things are far more complicated sometimes, and we have to confront those complications. More importantly, we get locked into a kind of identity politics that can be paralyzing and that can hinder our ability to develop a deeper analysis of occupation and a critique of nationalism, despite the fact that we read Fanon. Sometimes we don't read Fanon very carefully. And indeed, it's that kind of nationalist thinking that is partly explains why someone like my hero, I'm saying my intellectual hero, W.B. Du Bois, could tout the creation of Israel as an assertion of self-determination and as a model for Africa, the Caribbean, and the American Negro. So here we have an interesting case in point. What do you do at Ralph Bunche? Okay. Now, I'm in Bunche Hall, in this hall, right? My window's open. Every 30 minutes, someone is coming by giving the tour, saying, this is Bunche Hall, Ralph Bunche was the first black person with a Nobel Prize, blah, 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 and he did this to the creation of Israel. Well, what do we know about Ralph Bunche? Very interesting. Most of us know him as the UN Secretary for Peacekeeping who helped negotiate the end to the Arab-Israeli War in 1948 on terms generally considered favorable to Israel. True. He also becomes increasingly conservative over time and in some ways comes across as a kind of traitor to the struggles for justice. But then I'm reading this really amazing forthcoming book by Alex Lubin, who reminds us, and I kind of didn't realize this, that Ralph Bunche actually comes out of a Marxist tradition. And in fact, his initial encounters with the question of Palestine, in those encounters, he was dealing with a Jewish and Palestinian left attempting to move beyond the disastrous nationalism that left Europe in shambles. And instead, he and they were pushing for a binational or post-national solution to instead of partition. In other words, one nation for two people, or for all people. That's what he was pushing for. One nation, not partition. Okay, whatever the outcome is one thing, but that's what he was pushing for. And for that, he got flagged. Even Du Bois attacked him on that. So here we are in a moment when progressives are coming to terms with what it means to create one secular nation. Right? Ralph Bunche was already there. And he was there in part because he comes out of a particular Marxist tradition where binationalism made perfect sense. He wasn't about, he said, that if you create a Jewish state, it's going to be a disaster. And, more importantly, he got support from Jewish radicals and Palestinian left who said the same thing at the time. We have to know that history. If you really want deep solidarity, you have to know the whole history. And so, in some ways, these might be extreme examples, but they're important. They reveal how difficult solidarity can be. How difficult solidarity and struggle can be is actually evident in the formation of an organization I'm a part of that was formed just this summer called African Americans for Justice in the Middle East and North Africa. The real source behind that organization is the great Bill Fletcher, labor organizer. He was the head of TransAfrica for a while, and he decided to bring a lot of us together who are concerned about this issue and say, look, we're going to have a position. Now, if you think having a position is an easy thing to do, be on a conference call as we try to draft these statements just to announce an organization. But 3 hours on the phone trying to figure out what to say. What is our position? Okay, so this is very, very important. Again, I don't want us to get caught up too much into this idea that you just show up. Sometimes you show up and you debate. Sometimes you show up and you disagree. Sometimes you show up and you learn something you didn't know before. Because struggle is a process. So we go back to the short for Ajmina, which African Americans for Justice in the Middle East, North Africa. The idea was to bring together, to build solidarity with the peoples and progressive social movements in North Africa and the Middle East, fighting for democracy, national liberation, justice, and an end to occupation. We identified with the long-standing tradition of Pan-Africanism and Black internationalism. We're open to building alliances with anyone who shares a commitment to justice. We also believe that those of us in the U.S. actually do have a special duty to speak out in the belly of the beast, especially given U.S. support for Israel's occupation and other policies that undermine peace, justice, and democracy, and talk up a system of subjugation, not only of Palestinians, but of Mizrahim, of the Bedouins, of Africans, of immigrant labor from Asia and the Arab world, wherever, that we have to basically understand this. Our principles of unity include support for all genuine progressive struggles for national liberation, national sovereignty, justice, and democracy, support for the struggle of Palestinian people, end occupation, the right of return, equality and justice and full rights for all, including Palestinian and Arab citizens of Israel. And though our statement doesn't say this explicitly, we support BDS. Very strong. So just in closing, I think it's not enough to have solidarity. We need an analysis that can only come from study and engagement. And we cannot be afraid of our conclusions. Edward Said understood this better than anyone. He consistently forced us to question old categories, re-examine ethnic boundaries, and challenge received opinions in order to envision a new era of peace based on reconciliation between Palestinians and Jews. At the same time, as a radical humanist, he insisted on a deeper democratic transformation, not just for Israel-Palestine, but for the entire world, including the Arab world. In fact, his critique of Israel was leveled alongside his sharp criticisms of Arab elites and neoliberal policies. And though he may not have anticipated the Arab Spring, he called for it when he wrote, you know, the current Arab situation is truly depressing. For the rich in these countries, it is a tax-free zone. The poor are the only ones paying taxes. Meanwhile, the literacy and health problems are on the rise among children and youth. There is no excuse for this state of affairs, and it all stems from a lack of vision, leadership, and democracy in the region. And so, finally, I leave the last word to one of my other favorite thinkers, who I think is still relevant today, although he died March 14, 1883, and that's Karl Marx. In 1844, he wrote, and I always live by these words, if the designing of the future and the proclamation of ready-made solutions for all time is not our affair, then we realize all the more clearly what we have to accomplish in the present. I am speaking of a ruthless criticism of everything existing, ruthless in two senses. The criticism must not be afraid of our own conclusions, of its own conclusions, nor of conflict with the powers that be. Thank you.